this is Philosophy of the People with Stephen Bertram and Ben Burgess. There were some slight technical delays, but also a Ben delay, but here we are. And Ben, I was promised kind of a good, coherent critique of Marx with this one, not from you, but from this other person. But at least the first thing you present from this person seemed to me a pretty schoolboy kind of misunderstanding of what Marx means by exploitation. So what's up? I feel misled.
Fair enough. So the essay is a response to an article that Tibor Rutar, I'm not actually 100% if I'm pronouncing that name correctly or not. I'm supposed to speak to him tomorrow, so I suppose I'll find out then. But that he wrote for REO magazine earlier this summer, called Marxism, the idea that refuses to die. And, what I'm really giving him credit for here is it's not that I think that he's right about even really his characterizations of a lot of key Marxist ideas. I think some of that stuff is kind of B minus, but it's, I just having vastly more idea of what Marx is saying than certainly at least the anti-Marxists in the world today with who wield the largest megaphones, right? So, I think if you're used to reading critiques of Marx watching them or whatnot, from, again, some of the people in the world today who are the most popular, who spend the most time talking about Marxism, or at least using the word Marxism, then it's kind of refreshing, right? Because I think he does, on at least certain key points, I think he does have much more of a good idea of what Marx is up to, right? So, I'm thinking about people who I've responded to a lot in the past.
So he's all right because he didn't say that Marx is actually like a postmodernist who loves, who wants to make us all trans.
Exactly. yeah. I think that given, I sort of said B minus, but I mean, if we're sort of, if we're really letting Jordan Peterson and James Lindsay set the curve, then, we might have to give this an A+, it's because this is, so much of the stuff that you read from the right. Well, I'll even mention another recent example that I wrote about for Jacobin is Yoram Hazony, who is sort of the intellectual godfather of the NatCons, National Conservatives. Who I believe recently had a conference in the UK. It's sort of a very weirdly internationalist sort of nationalist movement. But Yoram, in his book from last year, Conservatism and Rediscovery, has a chapter called Challenge of Marxism, where, I do think he's a much smarter guy than your Petersons and your Lindsays. And God knows Ron DeSantis, he likes to say woke is cultural Marxism, things like that. But even there, he's really just sort of using Marxism as this bogey term for this much broader set of anxieties about left-coded things that he dislikes. And so, oftentimes when engaging with people like that, I'm thinking of Jordan Peterson here saying in his debate with Slavoj a few years ago, I'm going to stop myself and resist the opportunity to do a Jordan Peterson impression. I'm just going to say it in my own voice. But, somehow or another, Marx is admitting, he's confessing in the, opening of the Communist Manifesto that capitalism is really good at developing the forces of production. But if he admits that, what's the problem, right? That's the sort of level of that you get from people like this. Whereas, I do think Tibor has read you know, has read a decent amount, that he has a, you know, he has an idea of what some of Marx's central claims are. He's probably read a good amount of Marx as well as a good amount of secondary literature. I think that some of the stuff, like on exploitation in particular, you're right. Like, I think that's actually one of the worst sort of characterizations. And I have a sort of fairly specific idea of what might have happened there, you know, what might have sort of gone wrong.
I mean, because he says here, in attempting to say what Marx is saying, since the cost of their wages is always less than the profits that they allow the company to make. Surely he can't think Marx thinks that, because he's surely aware that Marx knows that some companies go bankrupt and don't make profits.
Also true. And
I think that's very interesting, because I think the fact that companies fail is related to the utility of talking about value as opposed to price.
Right. I mean, I will say certainly some of the stuff that Marx says in, you know, so one of the points, you know, that I make in response to Ruttar is that if you read Capital, Marx talks in different places about, you know, exploitation in value terms, which is, you know, what's sort of most robustly immune from that worry that you're raising about companies going bankrupt. But he also talks a lot about it in time terms, and in like labor, you know, that in other words, the sort of basic thing we talk about exploitation is forced labor, you know, having to do extra hours of labor beyond what you have to do to meet your own needs. And he also does, I will say, right, like if you read, like, I want to say chapter 25, Capital Volume 1, that he has, you know, when he starts talking about the variable capital fund, you know, he does seem to be talking pretty directly there about money, right? That in other words, you know, that if you sort of subdivide profits into, you know, into different portions, you know, then variable capital is one of Marx's terms for you know, labor power, basically, that the costs of paying people for their labor time. And, you know, said, okay, you think of like part of the capitalist profits as this variable capital fund, then even if, you know, the capitalist is essentially advancing it at first, you know, the fund is constantly being replenished, you know, through the work of laborers. And so, you know, they're paying their own, you know, wages or salaries, as well as, you know, generating the rest of the profits, right? So that part,
I think one of the main, the kind of the one of the funnest bits of Capital, and I think one of the most important bits, is when Marx is kind of going through, he's like asking rhetorically, you know, well, where does profit come from? And he goes through all of the kind of standard answers, which he thinks can't possibly be true. Like, for instance, the idea that profit arranges from some businessman being good and basically getting a deal over someone else. But this can't possibly be how the system works, because there's net profit.
Yeah, right. I mean, so I think what you're talking about there is back in like chapter 6, where he's saying, or leading up to it, I don't remember, where he's saying, you know, that there's this sort of mystery about, and this part is framed in terms of value, about where new value, you know, comes from. And, you know, as like, how is it that, I don't want to make this too in the weeds for people who've never read the book, but like, you know, but he has this, so he has this famous abbreviation in there, right? MCM, right? Money, commodity is money. So in the case of, you know, which is in contrast to, you know, which is the sort of a defining thing that has to be in place to have the capitalist mode of production, that this is like this dominant form of exchange, as opposed to the older one, which is CMC, right? Commodities, money, commodities. So if, in other words, somebody who's mostly producing for use, and they might like, you know, they might produce some excess and take it to market to sell it, to buy stuff that they can't produce for themselves. They're producing commodities and turning some of it into money for the purpose of getting other commodities. Whereas what the capitalist is doing is they're doing MCM. They're taking money and turning it into commodities for the sake of, really, it's MCM prime, right? Where the prime indicates there's more of it, or, you know, not just more because of inflation or whatever, but it represents more value that they're turning money into commodities, either in the case of merchant capital, commodities for resale, which takes you to the other, to M prime, right? Money, commodities, money. Or in the case of industrial capital, that they're, you know, the money, you know, commodities could initially be like capital goods that, you know, that so, and also, you know, the labor that they're buying, which turns into more money. So the purpose is to, you know, as I mean, you don't need Marx for this, right? Gordon Gekko, right? You know, you turn money into more money. And then he says it's a bit, you know, this is where he has all the stuff about how the capitalist is like a rational miser. The miser, you know, miser is just capitalist gone mad, you know, that, that, you know, the miser who's like stocking money, you know, in his closet or whatever, is like the capitalist insofar as both of them are fixated on making more money, not, you know, not because the capitalist, you know, bad moral character, but just because they're, you know, they better be fixated on it or else they're going to be outcompeted by other people who are. But then he says, well, hold on, but where does the, you know, how is it that the M becomes M prime, right? Where, as you say, where does the profit come from? And so he considers, it's like, okay, well, some people are better at business than others. You know, they buy cheap and sell dear, and that can take you a certain point. But that just explains how some capitalists become richer than others. It doesn't explain how, you know, profit as a whole, the system as a whole, increases over time. You know, so you know, that's where he says that what you need is some commodity that has the magical power of generating more value than it's worth.
Clearly it's gold.
Clearly it's gold. Yeah. That's the,
which is value itself.
That's the conclusion. That's the conclusion of capital, that you should buy gold. That was his point. Yeah. It's labor power, right? You know, the people's capacity to work. And yeah. And so in that chapter 25 discussion, I was thinking about, I think it's chapter 25 with the variable capital fund. Part of his point there is he says, look, let's assume for the sake of argument, Bitcoin, let's assume for the sake of argument that that it really is that you have capital that comes about in a really pristine, faultless way, right? So anybody who reads to the end of the book knows that, you know, this is not by and large what happened. You know, the whole last section about primitive accumulation is about, you know, he has this famous phrase about capital coming into the world, you know, dripping with blood and dirt from every pore, that, you know, all the peasants being driven off their land and all that stuff. But there's a reason that he waits till the end to get to that part, right? I mean, I'm sure if he'd been trying to sell this book to like Versa or even Sublation now, they would have made him move primitive accumulation to the beginning because it's a better hook. But there's a reason he saves it for the end, which is that, you know, he really wants to show, look, even if for the sake of argument it hadn't happened that way, it would still be the case that you have these relations of exploitation, even if capital had come about, you know, in this totally faultless way, right? So he says in his discussion, I'm thinking about, again, I think chapter 25, that in that, look, let's say the capitalist just comes about their initial funds to start the business in the most faultless possible way. Maybe they were a worker themselves and they just do a really good job of socking away money every week, you know, until they can
been chopping trees on unclaimed land and selling them for a fair rate to his fellow man.
Exactly, right? Even if that's the case, then it doesn't really change the essential point, because essentially this variable capital fund, in other words, the part of your profits out of which you're paying your workers, okay, the initial tank of gas comes from you chopping the trees on unclaimed land and selling them at a fair price, all this stuff.
Picking apples off trees that grew naturally.
Exactly, right? But then over time, like that, you know, that initial tank gets used up very quickly, and very quickly the workers themselves are doing the refilling of the tank of the variable capital fund, and that's what they're being paid out of. So over time, the relationship is still the same. Now, I mean, going back to Ruttar, I do want to be, I do want to say one slightly charitable thing before we get to all the reasons I think he's wrong, which is that there is, look, Marx is actually a incredibly good writer. He, at his best. I mean, he's a, I've been, you know, teaching this class where we read Proudhon's, the philosophy of poverty, and now we're reading Marx's response to the poverty of philosophy. And Matt, after like a couple months of reading Proudhon, I mean, reading Marx is just so good, right? It's you know, just as a prose stylist, it's just so much better, right? And the arguments are so much crisper, you know, it's just such a pleasure, right? But so Marx is an incredibly good writer at his best, and you know, his best is a lot. But he's not the kind of writer who tends to give you a lot of explicit definitions. Sometimes he does, right? But oftentimes he doesn't, right? You know, he doesn't often, you know, often he won't really pause to say, hey, to be really clear, here are some necessary and sufficient conditions for the application of this concept that I just invoked.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the literary style at the time, that you don't like end the chapter by saying, to summarize in brief detail, blah, 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 it's this, this, and this, and this, and this.
Yeah, exactly, right? So there is some interpretive work here. So I think that's like, I think that's one source of misunderstanding, right? There are arguments to be had, you know, Marxologists, right? You know, can you know, have a certain amount of argument about, you know, what's like, here are all the things he says about exploitation, which of these is like really definitional, and which of these are just sort of things that he thinks are true about it. So that's one thing. Another thing, though, I do think really specifically in Ruttar's case is that to go all ad hominem for a minute, I think he's in general somewhat prone to, I think you could maybe say like dataism or something, by which I just mean a sort of tendency to really want things to be solved by crunching numbers, and to sort of hope for things conceptually to be however they would have to be for that to be able to settle the question, right? And I'm kind of basing this on other interactions with him. Like, you know, he originally came to my attention because way back in the fall of 2021, I did this this 3-day conference kind of thing where there were some libertarians from the Mercatus Center, and then me and Hadass Tir from Jacobin, and we did like a few days of panels and, you know, arguing about stuff, and students applied to attend and stuff like that. And at this, you know, one of the readings one of the libertarians recommended was this thing by Peter Leeson called Two Cheers for Capitalism, where he makes very heavy use of these so-called economic freedom rankings that are put out by the Fraser Institute. And I think that these are, and like, because I had to read this article, I then went and checked out the Fraser Institute website and tried to tell what the methodology was. And I wrote this article for Jacobin called, like,
I mean, did you not check first if they were literally the CIA or like the Pentagon? Because I think Freedom House is either Pentagon.
Is that the CIA?
I think the NED or...
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. Which is also kind of funny, by the way, because the Freedom House rankings, this is completely off topic, so I promise we'll get back to the in 10 seconds. But because, you know, the Freedom House rankings are these days maybe not entirely congenial to... I don't know if they've updated them to be politically convenient.
Despite Ukraine's great sacrifice, they did not get an upgrade.
Yeah. Yeah, Ukraine's Freedom House rankings was, like, really bad before the war. It was, like, worse than Viktor Orban's Hungary, which, just to put that in context, I mean, the European Parliament recently said we don't really consider Hungary to be a democracy at this point, or maybe not a full democracy or something like that. This, like, backsliding, right? So... and in fact, I remember Tucker Carlson did a segment about, you know, Ukraine not being a democracy, and the Washington Post, when he was still on Fox, the Washington Post did this very weird fact check where they kind of said he was right, but he shouldn't say it. And it's an uncharitable summary, but it was a weird fact check. And in the fact check, they were like, well, if you look at the Freedom House rankings, Ukraine is about the middle of the pack for post-Soviet states. Like, man, that is a bad place to be.
Yes. at the bottom, you have like Turkmenistan, where the president proclaimed himself the father of all Turks.
Exactly. Like, it's not a good
Freedom House is State Department funded.
Yeah, I'm not very unsurprised. So, yeah, as far as I know, to be fair, Fraser might just be funded by a bunch of libertarian rich people. But in any case, like, I looked at this methodology and it was just ludicrously awful, which I was kind of expecting because some of the claims that Lisa made at the basis of it were...
Fraser is Canadian.
Yeah, it is Canadian, yeah. They have these bizarre consequences. Like, well, actually, on Ukraine, the Fraser Institute says that Ukraine has become Ukraine ends up in its list of countries that became less economically free between 1980 and 2005. So it's like, well, hold on. So the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic was more capitalist than Ukraine in 2005. That's a very odd result. And you sort of start to figure out what's going on there when you realize that they factor in all this stuff about, like, basically how much corruption and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's, like, all this stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with capitalism versus socialism per se, that, you know, you might say, if you're making an argument for capitalism, you might make arguments that it's, like, downstream of whether you have capitalism or socialism. But even if you do believe that, it's, you know, like, just sort of saying all the good things are definitionally capitalist is a weird way to argue for capitalism.
I think corruption is something that's been with us through all the economic systems. I think it's very one of the few consistent things.
Yeah. So I wrote this article saying these rankings were awful and the methodology was all jerry-rigged to get the result they wanted. And it means nothing. And Ruttar wrote a book called Capitalism for Realists, where he gives a sort of case, as I understand it, for, like, you know, he basically says, you know, he's not a libertarian, you know, he wants, like, a sort of moderate social democratic form of capitalism, but he still likes capitalism. And in this book, he has a couple pages where he talks about my Jacobin article, and he's like, no, but see, we can, like, re-crunch the numbers to take out, like, this and that and the other metric. And, you know, we still get, you know, these good results for markets. And, you know, we've had this big back and forth about this because my point is, like, well, hold, but you're ignoring a lot of the other conceptual problems with the rankings, right? Like, you're just kind of picking the, you know, the, here are the parts on which I kind of have the most dirt on why it's worthless. And I said, okay, well, let's leave those out, right? It's like, I think there are some more basic conceptual problems. And so my gentle ad hominem would be that I think he's, I think there's a certain, and I don't use this word in a hateful way, you know, I think it's an intellectual niche that needs to be filled, but there's a certain kind of data nerd who wants to sort of make all questions we can settle with data. And, you know, it just doesn't always work. And I think that's part of what's going on when he, with his argument about exploitation, that he really wants to make the exploitation question something you can give precise answers to with data. And I think that's one of the reasons, besides Marx, you know, not really spelling out necessary and sufficient conditions, that he gets it wrong. But I do think he gets it very wrong. Like,
it would be nice, I guess, if we could actually quantify exploitation in a very obvious way.
Yeah, but, sure.
I think the point that Marx makes and you make in the article is it's exactly the structure of capitalism, and he goes into quite a lot of details with this when he contrasts it with feudalism, is exactly the structure of capitalism that conceals the degree of exploitation. Because yes. Your hours of work for yourself versus your hours of work for the company or the boss or the capitalist.
Yeah, exactly.
Happens simultaneously.
Exactly, yeah. So a big point that Marx makes in Capital, you know, he's really like, so the comparison that he uses most often is feudalism versus capitalism. oh, wow. I didn't realize you'd, that's interesting. I know you had that background, Silver. By the way,
I was also a teenage ANCAP.
Sure. Yeah. Many people went through some, I was never quite that, and that is a subject for another day. But anyway, I was just gonna say, Silver, by the way, I've been meaning to, if you want to talk about the philosophy of mind stuff that you wanted to get into a while back when I was not really available to do it, I'd be happy to do that today. But anyway, on Discord. But in any case, So Marx spends a lot of time in Capital on this comparison between feudalism and capitalism. And it's... being a serial killer in your youth is probably worse than being an ANCAP in your youth. Being an ANCAP might lead to admiring serial killers, which Ayn Rand herself, who is not exactly an ANCAP, but yeah, Ayn Rand herself famously seemed to have a strange sort of crush on a serial killer as a young woman. But in any case, Marx spent a lot of time writing about the contrast between feudalism and capitalism. And he says different things about it in different places, but I think that it's all ultimately consistent. So in the Communist Manifesto, he says that feudalism, that there are certain sort of hallowed relations under feudalism that the veil is torn off of in capitalism, because everything is just sort of reduced to these naked relations of cash value. And in Capital, he sort of says the opposite. He says that the nature of feudalism is sort of right out of the open, and it's disguised under capitalism. I think these are actually consistent if you sort of think carefully about what he means by both. So the thing that's disguised under capitalism, but it's open under feudalism, is that there's this sort of paternalistic, like there's supposed to be these like deep human relationships between like lords and serfs, where they, you know, they each play their role in the great chain of being, and they each have duties to each other. And, you know, the lord is ultimately like your father and all this stuff. And the veil is just ripped right off of that under capitalism. It's like, no, this is, you know, we're just trying to make money from you. You know, you're on your own. But conversely, the extraction of what's produced by the peasant, by the lord, is right out of the open under feudalism. There's no missing it. So different versions of feudalism work different ways. And I know some historians don't even like the word feudalism anymore. We're supposed to say like manorialism or whatever. Feudalism is fine. But like the system does come in importantly different varieties. But In all of them, right, there is some pretty right out in the open kind of extraction going on. And the one that Marx spends the most time on and is sort of the clearest is where there's you have this like levee where you have so the peasant has their own little plot of land. They have certain property rights to that plot of land. They can't just like sell it and leave, right? But they do have certain kinds of exclusive use rights. And with this plot of land, they can grow food to feed themselves and their family, but they are legally required to spend a certain number of days or weeks a year working the Lord's fields and growing food that they're not going to get to use themselves. So here you have this right out in the open division between here's the labor time where you are you're making stuff for yourself, and here's the labor time where you're making stuff for the ruling class. And Marx's claim is that this same division exists under capitalism. But it's disguised by the form of capitalism. In other words, because there's this surface relationship, and it's not that it's like not also real in its own way, but it's like not the sort of most, it ultimately conceals something more important of market exchange between legal equals under capitalism, you know, that ultimately, you know, the worker is just...
They signed a contract, bro.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? They signed a contract. Nobody made them, right? There's no gun to the head. They signed an employment contract to their own free will, and you know, et cetera. And that's, you know, and that's all true to a certain extent. And you know, Marx himself is very concerned with, like, is very attuned to the fact that this represents historical progress over forms of society where you're not free to, you don't have to sign a contract. You're not allowed to quit. Marx is very enthusiastic.
You couldn't sign a contract if you wanted to because you're completely illiterate.
It's because you're completely illiterate. Even if you did know how to read, you wouldn't have the status as a citizen to sign legal documents, and, you know, et cetera, right? I mean, you know, Marx thinks the bourgeois revolution is a good thing. He's very enthusiastic about the Union cause and the Civil War. So he is attuned to the fact that this is progress, but it's not enough progress because, you know, he thinks ultimately, you have a choice and you don't. That you are still compelled because under capitalism, the means of production are in the hands of non-workers. The formulation, the critique of the Goethe program, that there is this class of people who own the means of production. And sure, some workers will make the jump to become capitalists themselves, but most won't. Mathematically, most just can't, right? There just aren't that many lifeboats out of the working class. So what that means is, in practice, realistically, most people are going to have no choice except to sign employment contracts that, you know, submit themselves to the rule of capitalists, right? This is the dull compulsion of economic necessity, or mute compulsion, you know, of economic necessity. It talks about different places. And once you've done that, right? So this is, and that's crucial, because like the whole thing about exploitation, you know, if Marx thinks that at the sort of deepest level, the most important thing that exploitation is like forced hours of unpaid labor, then that's the force, right? Is from the fact that just having this set of property relations means there's this, you know, mute compulsion that, you know, that you have to do it. This, like, the same way I think we'd have no problem saying that if somebody is, you know, we have no problem saying somebody's forced to do something if they have to pay a fine if they don't do it, right? You know, I think becoming becoming destitute or, you know, going on whatever temporary welfare you're allowed to go on or, you know, living on the streets or whatever is a pretty potent engine of force. So, okay, and then once you have signed this employment contract, then you are, then what's going on? Well, you are, there are the hours a day that you're working to refill that variable capital fund that, you know, that you're making the equivalent of what you get back. And, but then there are other hours of the day that it doesn't, that you're working to enrich the capitalist, that it's that even though the legal form of it is it's all paid, right? You know, that in Marx's time, here's your day of labor, here's your wage for the day of labor, or in later forms of capitalism, you know, it's even broken down by the hour, you know, here's what you're being paid per hour, here's how many hours you worked. So that's the legal form of it. But Marx says, in essence, you are working, you're working more, like, look, the very fact that there is profit, that it doesn't just all go into your wages, right? That, you know, you're working.
Yeah, why can't I say to my boss, can I not stop an hour early? And then whatever money that would have come off net for you, not do that.
Yeah, exactly. That won't go over well. That would defeat the point.
And of course, it wouldn't actually work.
Sure. Yeah. So in, I mean, I was actually looking at this fun, I don't quote this, but actually working very hard to limit all these to 3,000 words each, right, as the strict upper limit. So, you know, there are lots of stuff I'd like to throw in that I can't, but for the class I mentioned, I was looking recently at something Engels wrote, which is very relevant here. So it's the preface to the first German edition of Poverty of Philosophy, and he's criticizing this guy Robertus, who has this scheme for like labor time money, and he says that, you know, if you just made it open like that, like, you know, here's how many hours of work you did, here's how, you know, here's how much you're getting paid, you know, that if you were told, you know, like you're working 12 hours and you're getting paid for four of them, then people wouldn't accept that, right? One must be a Pomeranian manor owner in order to imagine that a working class would put up with working 12 hours in order to receive a certificate for 4 hours of labor. If the hocus pocus of capitalist production is translated into this naive language in which it appears as a naked robbery, it is made impossible. One need never have seen any other proletariat than the, so he says every certificate given to a worker saying how many hours they'd worked versus how many hours they're being paid for would be a direct instigation to rebellion. It would come under Article 110 of the German Imperial Criminal Code against instigated rebellion. One need never have seen any other proletariat than the day labor proletariat, still actually in semi-serfdom of a Pomeranian manor where the rod and the whip reign supreme and where all the beautiful women in the village belong to the lordship's harem, in order to imagine one can treat the workers in such a shamefaced manner. So, you know, so yeah, this is, so in essence, you are, you know, you're working a certain number of hours a day and you are generating a certain amount of stuff in those hours. You know, I mean, if you're at the George Jetson, you know, widget factory, I think that sprocket factory, right? You know, you make a certain number of sprockets over the course of the day. And only some of those are equivalent to what you get back in wages, then the rest of it is being extracted from you. And because Marx thinks you have no real choice except to agree to this arrangement, given the way capital's property relations are set up, then that is forced unpaid labor. And the crucial point here is that I think that is really where I think Ruttar most falls down in his critique, is that I don't that when you talk, you know, the force is really the key thing. It's not just that there's a gap between what you produce and what you're getting back. Because Marx is very explicit about this, and I think he's right to be explicit about this. In any possible society, there's going to be some kind of gap. There's even like a footnote in Capital where he says something like this, but like he goes into this in detail in that first chapter, the Critique of the Gotha Program, where it's like, look, if you know, even if we had communism, like full-on marketless, moneyless, you know, communism, it's not like we don't still need to build factories to make stuff. It's not like we don't still need to maintain the factories we've already done. It's not like whatever kind of administrative apparatus is needed to run it all, even if it's a radically democratic one, doesn't need some sort of resources to keep going. It's not like we don't need schools and hospitals. Surely, you know, he says, look, even in, you know, like 19th century capitalism, there was some kind of state poor relief. And surely, he says, we think there should be more, not less, consumption for those unable to work under communism. So for all these reasons, you know, he calls these deductions, right? You know, it's not that the workers are getting back the full product of their labor. That just can't be how it works. And by the way, he's very clear that we're talking about productive. Marx is actually, I think, appropriately skeptical about breaking it down to the individual, individual contributions in any case. But it's not even that the workers collectively, you know, are getting back in sort of direct consumption and, you know, wages or the marketless communist equivalent of wages, where somebody reminded me this line in class today. He says, well, this wouldn't be like money. It'd be like the chip with the opera when you check your coat and, you
exchange. Yeah, the communist Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The communist Chuck E. Cheese token, right? Equivalent of wages. It's not that you get back the full product in Chuck E. Cheese tokens. You have, as a real nice highbrow, lowbrow contrast there between Marx's example and that one. That can't possibly be how it works. So it seems to me, and this is again where I think the sort of trying to make it a question that can be settled by data is ultimately unconvincing, as nice as that would be, that the point is that it's not that the worker isn't getting back the full product. It's that they don't have a say in the matter, right? That it's being taken for, you know, it's not that like somebody has sort of made a good case.
Right. I mean, it's not going to your poor grandma.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not that like there's some sort of democratic process in which the workers themselves have a considerable say and that's deciding it. It's just taken by exercise of class power. That's really what makes it exploitation. And, you know, so like I always, you know, think like if you think about, look, even internally democratic cooperatives don't necessarily have completely flat wage scales. There might be all sorts of reasons. And, you know, I think even if you're imagining a totally market.
Right, I mean, he also talks about this in the Gotha program. It was a problem. In the lowest stage of communism, about how some workers will inevitably get more stuff or more Chuck E. Cheese tokens or whatever because they'll work better.
Yeah, if you're awarding the Chuck E. Cheese tokens on the basis of duration or intensity, Marx says, you are, inevitably some people are not just going to be like less lazy or whatever. Some people are just going to be able to work longer or more intensely than others for all sorts of reasons. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that the Chuck E. Cheese tokens are ultimately unsatisfying. And we should really try to get to that like abundant higher stage communism where you can dispense with them. I think there are all sorts of reasons why a non-capitalist setup, I mean, again, like existing cooperatives, you know, which Marx did sometimes point to as sort of important, you know, I'm losing the word, but like whatever, like proof of concept of like the possibility of modern industrial production without a division of workers and capitalists, that you know, even cooperatives, it's not like everybody earns exactly the same wages, even in the sense that they would in Marx's first stage of communism. There are all sorts of reasons why you might be able to democratically convince people to pay some members more than others. Who's not arguing for a worker state? I'm very confused by that chat. But anyway,
it's you, I guess.
It's me. Okay. Well, for the record, I'm for it. Put me down as a yes for worker state. But in any case,
that's what 2 euros buys you, chat.
Writing a book with Bhaskar and Mike Beggs about how such a thing could work. Just in any case.
I wanted to ask, I don't know, are you finishing an important
point? I was going to say real briefly, right? There are all sorts of reasons you might be able to convince people to pay some people more than others. Like if you are asking somebody to take on a job that involves like unusual amounts of stress and responsibility, then you might want to offer them, you know, a higher salary as an incentive to take that. Conversely, I mean, this is unfortunately the exact opposite of how things all too often work under capitalism. But in a system where people weren't just motivated by desperation to take particularly dirty and dangerous jobs like they are right now, where, you know, everybody was starting off at the same economic level, and that kind of system, you'd actually have to offer people more as an incentive to take particularly dirty and dangerous jobs. And that's all fine. But, you know, what you're not going to get, and this is the sort of distributive inequality that exists under capitalism. I mean, if you imagine,
you know, under the lowest stage of communism, the guys who like fix sewers will have a king's ransom of Chuck E. Cheese tokens.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, but like, look, if you show up to the meeting of like a, you know, internally democratic version of Amazon and be like, hey, you know, this whole thing was Jeff's idea, so I think he should get paid so much more than the rest of us. He won't actually have to do anything in particular, maybe sign off on the occasional final decision. I think he should
take steroids and go to the beach.
Exactly. He should be paid so much more than the rest of us that he could buy his own spaceship. I don't know. I think that would be a hard sell at a meeting where everybody got a vote.
The question I wanted to ask you, Ben, is, you know, you're talking earlier about exploitation and so on, and how, you know, there's this gap between what you produce and what you get and so on. But if you don't believe in value as separate from price, how do you know that? Because at that point, those things don't have a price. And you don't know what price they have in fact sold for in some kind of future state.
Yeah, I mean, there is a complicated argument about value here that I punt on in the reading. I sort of lodge a complaint in passing that Ruchar doesn't acknowledge the existence of the sort of most serious defenses of labor time value theory that exist. Because those do exist. I'm not convinced that you need that as a premise to make a lot of these arguments that we're talking about work. Because if you're worried about whether or not that's true, and that's a big, complicated empirical argument.
No, I mean, I'm happy for Marxism to have fallback states if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that in a weird way, as far as the question you're raising here, like, it's not even that postulating labor time value at least in Marx's version. And if you're going to postulate it, it better be Marx's version, because the other versions are a lot less plausible, is going to help that much. In other words, because remember, you know, if you read the first chapter of Capital, Marx's version of labor value theory is, and, you know, every time I say a sentence about this, I have in my head like the three or four people who'd be yelling about it from different perspectives because they interpret all this differently. But, you know, just going with the boringly standard interpretation of what Marx is saying in the first chapter of Capital and ignoring, you know, Heinrich and all that stuff, right? Then just, okay. You know, it's not that, like, anytime anybody is doing labor, that they are creating value in the amount of labor that they're doing. In fact, it's a little bit unclear whether creating is even exactly the right word here, because for Marx, he says value is ultimately understood in terms of average socially necessary labor time in the abstract, right? I mean, this is the stuff that's often missed by the kind of, you know, barstool libertarian critics who think it's like really clever to say, if value's, you know, about labor time, then if somebody takes a long time to make something, it's more valuable. They're revealing themselves as not having read the first few pages of the book, and in which he's very careful to make these distinctions, but also, okay, so it's the, you know, so it's an average. So again, it's not even clear that, you know, what you're doing is creation exactly. And, you know, there's a reason that I didn't want to get very much into this in the essay, because there are a lot of thorny questions here. But in any case, part of the socially necessary is that it's not, if you're just kind of like making things that nobody wants to buy, then that's not socially, you know, part of the socially necessary thing is, I mean, part of it's saying that they, you know, it's the socially necessary average, right? In other words, it's like, given the current state of technology, et cetera, right? This is on average how long it takes. But I think part of what he is saying is that it's like, it's not that just any old thing that people do that they're getting paid to do, if you're not actually generating, you know, products or services that people want, is going to count.
I think you make an important point in the essay, which is to say that Marx is not trying to describe every social relation that's ever happened and like every act of every human that's ever done something. And so when someone's like, well, what about this fucking idiot who's doing some bullshit? It's like, well, it doesn't matter. Unless idiots doing bullshit is the dominant social relation. It's the same thing with mud pies, with picking apples off trees. All this stuff can and does go on, but it's just not the point that Marx is making.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, it's certainly, you know, I think if it is true that, and... Yeah, and also, by the way, this the social average is determined at the point where, you know, you're going to market. But in any case, I don't want to get down a whole blind alley about this. I'll just say this, that that whatever is true about the value theory stuff, it's still going to be true that you are making a bunch of sprockets over the course of your day at the Jetsons factory, or, you know, whatever, that one seemed pretty automated, but, you know, the earlier versions of it, you know, they're less automated, you know, you're making a certain number of sprockets over the course of the day. And the you is a collective you, you know, it's like the workforce at the factory, and making a certain amount of sprockets, and the sprockets are being, you know, like the sprockets are being sold, right? I mean, in fact, this is in Capital Volume 2, this is the distinction between productive and non-productive, you know, labor, that the, that whether you are in fact refilling the tank on the variable capital fund through, because you're making stuff that the capitalist is profiting from that in turn go back to your wages and all that stuff. So
it's crazy on the whole Haz thing that in, I don't know if it's volume two or three, Marx comes basically as close to possible to literally saying that Starbucks workers are productive workers.
Yeah. Yeah. He says a cook at a hotel. I mean,
in a hotel, yeah, or a canteen or something.
Yeah, that could not be closer to, especially because how many hotels have Starbucks in them now? But yeah, that's...
You.
Yeah, exactly.
You think he isn't the God Emperor from Dune who sees the future, Ben, but actually he is.
Fair enough. So yeah, you're making a certain number of sprockets. The sprockets are making, the sprockets are making the capitalist a certain amount of money. You're getting a certain amount of it back a certain amount of it is going back to refilling the variable capital fund that your wages come out of. And there's still going to be a gap there. So it just is true that you're working a certain number of hours a day for yourself, right? Making the sprockets that are the equivalent to what you get back in your wages. And you're working a certain number of hours a day to make the sprockets that are not equivalent to what you're getting back in your wages, that are the extra stuff. And so I think really the question about whether that's exploitation comes down to the question of, do you think this is like, do you, does you signed a contract, bro, actually settle the question? Or is there a kind of compulsion here, given the way capitalist property relations are set up, that makes this ultimately involuntary unpaid labor? By the way, last thing about this, if you want to spend a few minutes on the history part, before we end, but like he also makes the point that slavery is the division between paid and unpaid labor is also obscured by the economic form, just in the opposite way for capitalism. Under capitalism, you appear to be paid for every hour. Under slavery, you appear to be paid for none of the hours. It's all unpaid, right? But even there, you are actually getting some of it back. I mean, not justify slavery or, make it a particularly appealing deal. But it's not that every single hour is enriching the slave owner, that you are some of the hours that you work, the cotton that you pick or whatever, you are creating the equivalent of what you're getting back in what your food and shelter and all that costs the slave owner, right? So under slavery, you have the superficial form of it's all unpaid, that all of the hours that you're working are not for yourself. Under capitalism, you have the superficial form that all of the hours are paid, all of the hours you are working for yourself. And feudalism is sort of admirably honest about this. Like it's just right out in the open, which hours you're working for yourself and which hours you're working for the Lord. And I guess just the last thing maybe I'd say about this is just it's an important point. It's easy to get lost. Like why... normatively maybe we can do one on the question of the state of the future. It's an interesting question, and I was being a little flippant earlier, but I promise at some point I will write something about Marxism and the Marxist theory of the state. But
that's what 5 euros get you. Much better answer than for 2 euros. Pay attention, chat.
look at us generating our variable capital. For YouTube, I guess. Okay. Like, normatively, why does all this, I think there is a really important point here about what Marx cares about. Which is like a little bit sideways to the essay, because the essay is just kind of like, hey, here's why I think all this analysis is correct, and that the critiques ultimately miss the mark. But I think if what Marx ultimately cares about is human freedom. That, you know, we have, it's kind of the opposite, actually, of this sort of cartoon of Marx in a lot of people's heads, where it's like, okay, Marx talks about workers all the time, so therefore Marx must like really valorize labor. No, not really. Like, I mean, what Marx valorizes is getting to spend your time the way you want to, you know, pursuing.
I mean, it's that bit where he's talking about teachers in Volume 1, where he's like, you know, you don't have to actually produce a real thing to be a worker. What you have to be is exploited, like to be run down like a workhorse or whatever. And he says, yeah, that being a worker is a curse.
Yeah, I mean, even a teacher at a private school is a productive worker in his sense, because it doesn't actually matter that you're not, you know, physically producing anything except, I guess, you know, some words on a chalkboard. But what matters is that there is this relationship of exploitation, that you are making you are producing the stuff for your boss that you get back some of, but not all of, you know, that is the money that he's charging for your services. Okay.
Yeah, let's do history, because on this bit, I was like, maybe he does have a point. But I wasn't really sure what he was saying, what Marx was saying. So
yeah. Yeah. So I was just going to say, like, yeah, ultimately cares about freedom, that, you know, that you're sort of pursuing your own projects and exercising your own creative potential. Good. Yeah, you should definitely try that job interview. So, of course, we can't. But, you know, one of the big themes of Capital is that we really want to distinguish between what's historically specific to the mode of production that we've got and what is just sort of a function of the material production process, however we socially organized it. And says, look, a certain amount of the work that you have to do, you know, what's forcing you to do it is just like nature. And fair enough, there's definitely a sense in which we're freer if we automate that away or whatever. But you know, as far as like social freedom goes, then that's why this whole question of the hours of unpaid labor becomes crucial. That it's the part that you're being forced to, you know, you don't have any input about it, and you're being forced to, not by the way that, you know, like the world being a veil of tears or whatever, independent of human volition, you're being forced to by the social system being set up the way it is. But anyway, you want to talk about history. Let's do it.
Well, what does this guy take to be Marx's account that he has a problem with? Is it the idea that kind of, it's just kind of, we invent new stuff and that changes new stuff, but doesn't really explain why the new stuff got invented in the first place?
Yeah, among other things. So, this is where I do want to give Ruttar credit for like just having a vastly better idea of what he's talking about than a lot of the sort of anti-Marxists with the loudest megaphones, that, you know, he does understand fundamentally that it's the... that Marx thinks that the development of the forces of production over time, right, the expanding capacity of a society to produce stuff, is the sort of thing that's most fundamentally explanatory, and that what relations of production you have, whether you have workers and capitalists or lords and peasants or, you know, slavery or whatever, is ultimately downstream of the level of development of the forces of production. That alone is like, man, he knows so much more than the guys we were talking about do. And the kinds of criticisms that he makes here, I should also say, are oftentimes the kinds of criticisms that are made by people who are within the Marxist tradition, who are like somewhat revisionary on this stuff, right? I mean, it's like he's... He tends to think that So what are his objections? Again, you know, I should say, like, there are people who I like who make similar sorts of objections that, you know, some of them at least, right? Some of them I think are not really nearly as good, but so there are a couple of kinds of objections you can make. So when Marx talks this way, and even if you haven't read even if you haven't read the 1859 preface, which is where Marx sort of lays out most explicitly this theory of history, even if you've just read like the Communist Manifesto, he says stuff like this and there. There are places in Capital, he says very similar things. You know, he'll talk about there coming a point in the development of the forces of production where like the old relations of production become a fetter. And this is an explanation of how you go from one mode of production to another, that you know, the old ones were fettering the further development of the forces of production, and you know, so, and ultimately the forces win, you know, that they break free from the fetters imposed by the relations. And again, I think plenty of people who are in many ways Marxists, who believe, you know, accept a lot of what Marx says about class struggle and et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think for have serious reasons for questioning this picture. I don't ultimately find them convincing, but I mean, I think a lot of what he's tapping into is stuff that, again, are just, I mean, look, maybe I'm just grading him on way too generous a curve, but I mean, it's just refreshing to at least see somebody writing a Marxism Sucks article where they're at least on the real issues it's like they're at least talking about the real problems. So there are two kinds of objections that he's talking about in various places here. And I was just looking behind me at the bookshelf, but I did not see the book that I was looking for there.
I thought the dog was about to appear on screen.
No, the dog is, I don't know. It's been raining on and off. She might be under the couch, So there's a set of conceptual objections to this. Okay, how does this work? What's the mechanism? Does this even make sense? Is there a kind of backward causation here that the new economic system leads to greater development of the forces of production, and so that's why you have a new economic system? Is that like the sort of wrong order of causation, right? So those are the conceptual worries. And then even after you've sorted those out, there are empirical worries that, like, okay, even if this is coherent, is that what happened, right? If you look at things like Ruchar mentions the French Revolution, or you look at things like the beginnings of capitalism in England, you know, is this what happened, or is what happened a lot murkier than that and a lot more tied into sort of messy local contingent factors than you'd get from reading Marx's preface? And on the conceptual question,
I mean, if capitalism is contingent, it's managed to like roll well in like 192 countries.
Yeah, that's kind of ultimately what I say right in the essay, that it's like that there's like something. It's not just like, I think there are things about this story that you can say, well, this is just kind of happenstance that it happened this way. But there's also a point where it's like, was it the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead? There's the Stoppard play, this thing at the where they're like flipping a coin and they flip it like 500 times a row, and you know, and it keeps coming up either heads or tails, whichever one it is, and it's like, yeah, something's going on here, right? I think.
I mean, it's sort of this kind of evolutionary thing. And I think, I don't know if I think of Marxism as in too Darwinian a way. But, you know, it only takes capitalism winning once in somewhere significant to then, you know, do imperialism to people and then they become capitalists.
Yeah. So the book, which I think is on the couch, I'm not going to get up and get it, you know, but I was going to flash on screen, that I would always recommend to people here, is called Karl Marx's Theory of History by G.A. Cohen. And you know, one of the things I kind of give Ruchar a hard time about in this essay is that I'm pretty sure he's read it, because a lot of his formulations suggest that this is sort of the presentation of the theory that he's thinking about, but he never really name checks it, which is a shame, because if he did, he might actually have to grapple with some of the arguments from that book, which he kind of treats, because he sort of treats the conceptual objections as unsolvable in a way that's like, okay, but come on, I'm pretty sure you've read this book that spends whole chapters giving you elaborate arguments about how to understand this stuff and making all these very careful distinctions and et cetera. I'd really like to hear your response to all that. But real briefly, like you mentioned evolution, and you know, Cohen in that book is this is an analogy he leans on a lot, you know, is evolutionary selection. It's not, you know, because look, if you were describing Darwinian evolution on the right level of abstraction, it might sound like you had a backward causation problem, right? You know, it's like, well, how is it that the fact that the stuff will benefit them means that it comes to get about, whatever. It's like, okay, look, you can get, you know, you can get things coming about for all sorts of reasons, but the point is that they're going to be selected for because they're better at developing the forces of production. And I think he says a lot of plausible things about the sort of causal pathways by which something being better at developing the forces of production could be helpful for that, you know, relation sticking around and, you know, and prospering and, you know, remaking other social institutions around it, et cetera. And, you know, so I think I find Cohen very convincing on the conceptual objections. The better objection, you already kind of suggested my answer to this, but it's like the better objection is the empirical objection, the is that what happened objection. So there's this guy Brenner who wrote about the origins of capitalism in England after the Black Death, and how the sort of circumstances of the plague and all that led to capitalism, you know, getting the kind of foothold that it did. And you know, I think, and there's this whole Brenner debate about, is this true? Is this like just historically correct? If so, what should we conclude from it? And my view is that ultimately what this does is it exposes an ambiguity about, like, it makes us sort of think a little bit more carefully about what the claim is supposed to be. Is the claim, like, is the question we're trying to answer when we ask these questions about the relationship between the forces of production and relations of production, is the question we're trying to answer, how is it that capitalism got its first foothold in the world? Or is the question we're trying to answer, how is it that capitalism swept away everything else and became the globally dominant mode of production to the point where to find anything but capitalism, you have to, like, at this point, I mean, my God, I mean, like, I guess there's like North Korea and there's that like island where they always like shoot arrows at missionaries, you know, but like, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but right, you know.
Yeah, it's like, and it's not like the world that capitalism came into was a global domination of feudalism either. Yeah. Capitalism, because it's better than feudalism in these kind of qualitative ways, got to crush a lot of slave societies too.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, you had like this, you had feudalism sort of dominant in, you know, Europe and, you know, some other places in different ways and some kind of, you know, but yeah, you had various forms of pre-capitalist class society that existed before. And then capitalism just crushed everything to the point where it's like, it's really, its tendrils have reached like almost everywhere that there's any kind of human habitation in the world today. And I think that straightforwardly has a lot to do with the fact that capitalism is so good at developing the forces of production, that, you know, unleashing the productive power of society. And I think that's, and I think part of the thing here is that there isn't just one causal pathway. There are any number of different causal pathways connecting being really good at developing the forces of production to coming to become the dominant global mode of production. That, you know, one of them is One of them you kind of suggested earlier with the thing about imperialism, that if you are wildly more productive, then, you know, you're going to have more resources to spend on your military, and and, you know, you could just conquer other places. You know,
I mean, bring up something from before. Bourgeois capitalists were also the first person to say, like, maybe we shouldn't have corruption and nepotism.
Yeah.
It was really, I remember a strange conversation I had with someone on Reddit Ask Philosophy where they just couldn't possibly see the problem with nepotism. And it's like the whole world that you're in compared to what came before is so much structured by the fact that while we haven't defeated nepotism or anywhere close, we have crushed it down so much compared to how it once was.
Yeah, no, that's also very true. I mean, I think, yeah, so I mean, the military thing is important. And by the way, the point here is not that capitalism sort of arises from colonialism, which is a thing that people sometimes think that I think is actually historically not quite right. It's that capitalism makes you more effectively a colonialist. You know, if you look back at like the Spanish Empire, when they, you know, weren't particularly capitalist, like it wasn't actually that efficient for them. There's like a reason why, you know, they that didn't sort of remain the dominant form of imperialism. There's you know, there's also just various ways in which you know, I mean, that you can, you know, like, you know, you have stuff that, you know, that other people want, and they need to sort of enter into trade relations with you to you know, to get it. And, you know, and that sort of ends up, you know, exporting, you know, capitalist relations. There's the, you know, there's just other people, you know, in those countries, whatever, seeing an opportunity, et cetera. And so, you know, given that you have some development support for production, by the way, we kind of skipped over this, but probably one of his more plausible objections is, okay, does Marx's picture sort of suggest that it's just always going to be true that technology is at least slowly improving over time? And if so, what's the guarantee that that would be the case, right? You know, that in other words, if like developing forces of production, you know, gives you the possibility of capitalism in the first place, why are they developing even under feudalism, et cetera? I would just say to that, I think there's more than nothing to that worry, but I also think that, you know, like, you don't actually need that much for it to be true that the forces of production are developing at least a little bit. Like, if somebody invents...
Yeah, also, I think you can purely develop the forces of production by changing social relations without changing, like, mechanistic facts about what methods of input we use or whatever. Like what tools we use or so on. Also depends how we understand technology.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, like, I do think that, you know, even if you have like 100 years between every invention that, you know, comes into wide use, like that is still over the course of time, development of the forces of production.
A fun idea I had, I think about it quite a lot, is what if kind of like an industrial civilization was about to develop, but unlike how actual human civilization went, there weren't just these massive trapped carbon stores, which were like easily accessible and massively rapidly accelerate our industrial process. And of course, in the end, like credit card debt, we are now paying for it more and more, this rapid use of carbon. But I think it's very interesting to wonder how slowly capitalism would have developed without this.
Yeah, no, fair. So yeah, I mean, going back to the early point, like, I think I have no trouble. Look, history is weird and complicated and messy. And
it's only happened once, so it's hard to get data about.
Exactly, right? We really don't have a control group, you know, to peer into.
Why we need to do space imperialism to prove if Marx is right.
Yeah. Investigate all the other planets and see how, see how they went through the phases of history. Although also, of course, famously, there is a school of thought, you know, Posadaism, that says that, you know, given that Marx is right, other people will come to us, since they'll, you know, the surely, you know, there are socialist
aliens. Right. I mean, if the guy confessing to the US government about how there's spaceships or whatever, if he's saying those aliens aren't communists, then he's wrong.
Yeah. But yeah, so okay, history only happened once. What happened in history is very complicated. And it's not monocausal. And there's even stuff that he says. I mean, there are a bunch of things that he covers a lot of ground in this essay. And I kind of picked a few of the things that seem most important to me to respond to. But, you know, he talks about dialectics. He talks about the falling rate of profit. You know, one of the things, even about history, that I didn't really talk about is he sort of cast doubt on the idea that we should, that, you know, we should expect like everything that's ever happened. You know, every big event, you know, World War One, French Revolution, whatever, to like have this sort of pat Marxist explanation, which I think is kind of right, right? It's like, look, things are really complicated and multi-causal. You know, if Marxism is supposed to be a theory of, you know, that's going to sort of give you an exhaustive explanation of everything that's ever happened to anybody, then I think it's probably not going to be true, right? I mean, like, it's that's maybe not a realistic ambition. You know,
certain things developing really changed the structure of imperialism how it worked, like nuclear weapons, which Marx could have never anticipated. But that doesn't mean that after these weapons have been developed and you can include them in your data set, that you can't then kind of think about these things in terms of Marx's history.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like the sort of meme line, you know, it's like Marx failed to anticipate the split into the atom. Seen in Oppenheimer's in my head, where he's, you know, Oppenheimer's just done this, like, demonstrated on the chalkboard with a step-by-step proof that it's impossible. And guy's like, yeah, somebody in the lab next door just did it. So.
And they got him for being a communist, even though he disproved Marx.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, so he's, so I think it's probably, Marxism is probably not plausible as an exhaustive theory of everything that's ever happened. I think that if you accept it as a theory of why it is that different modes of production rise and fall over the course of history, I think it's fair to say that it's going to have a lot, it's going to be able to tell you a lot about a lot of the other things that happen, but you know, that's but you know,
probably, yeah, I mean, that's why I'm really suspicious of kind of dialectic materialism versus historical materialism. Like, yeah, I would suppose it is really neat if we think about kind of quantum physics in terms of dialectics or whatever, but it's such an insane coincidence. I think it just makes you sound like a cultist.
I'm largely with you there, yeah, know largely about it, I agree with that, but anyway, yeah. So I think that's all fair. I think that if, you know, I think that if the question is how does capitalism get its first foothold in the world, then I'm pretty happy to say that, yeah, you know, your story is about weird, contingent, messy, local things that happened are probably more correct than not. But I think the more sort of interesting question is, how is it that capitalism wasn't just this thing that existed in England for a little while, but it's this thing that exists everywhere and is almost impossible to imagine seeing the back of now. And that seems to have everything to do with how good capitalism is at developing the forces of production. The fact that the Soviet attempt at socialism, you know, did gain a foothold in the world, actually a pretty considerable foothold in the world. The Soviet Union took up 1/6 of the landmass of the planet at the high point of that system. You know, I think this might be adding up China with the Soviet sphere of influence, but I think, you know, I've seen estimates that like a third of the people in the world were living under that system at one point. So that's a pretty considerable foothold, but it didn't keep it. And the fact that it didn't keep it seems to have quite a bit to do with the fact that that particular attempt at having a kind of socialist society was not very good at unleashing, you know, forces of production. I mean, it, you know, it was and it wasn't. It was good at sort of initial rapid industrialization. You know, it was, it ended up being very bad at you know, coordinating production with consumer needs. And that seems to have this is really not even a particularly Marxist claim. This is just a sort of, I think, general common sense historical claim that seems to have had quite a bit to do with the fall of that system, and also the fact that they, that technologically, you know, they ended up being way behind the West. Like, that seems to have had a lot to do with it. I mean, if we want a successful flourishing socialism, it better be one that's better at all that, right? So I think I think at least on I think that Ruhtar is vastly better informed than a lot of critics of Marx. I mean, even some of the stuff like I think the exploitation part, I think, is a bigger misreading of Marx than the than the history stuff. And even there, some of what he says about it in the article is pretty well informed, even if what he says, I think, ultimately misses the point. Certainly on the history stuff, I think he just has an amazingly better idea. And again, a lot of the stuff he's drawing from is actually drawing from sort of, Marxist people who come out of the Marxist tradition, who are revisionary on some of the theory of history stuff. Vivek Chibber comes up in this article several times. So, I think it's like a way more serious critique than, the sort that I was writing about when I, back in, the talk I gave at Hay was republished by Jacobin under the title, "Have Any of Karl Marx's Critics Today Actually Read Him?" And that article led a lot of people to grumble. It's like, but I'm not like dealing with the better ones. I'm just talking about the shitty critics. And, fair enough. I would point out that the shitty critics have like 10,000 times the reach of the better critics. But in that case, I was talking about the shitty critics. And, I think Ruhtar is a much better critic than those people. But ultimately, I don't find him convincing. I think that like the sort of core claims about how capitalism works and how history progresses and stuff are largely correct. And, I think the reason, to go back to the title of his article, I think the reason Marxism doesn't die is in part that I think people can correctly tell that it has explanatory power, to make sense of the world as it exists today. And they're not wrong for thinking that.
And you're debating him tomorrow?
Yes, correct.
And next Sunday?
Oh, I don't know. I guess we're talking about Marxism anyway. Might as well do the Gnosticism.
Best. It's even out of the state. Where is the outro? Bye.